Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump delivers his speech on foreign policy. What did he say? Who was his real audience? The newest round of talks on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, is taking place in New York this week. But what exactly is TTIP, and why are most of the negotiations being carried out in secret between the United States and the European Union? The FBI is unlikely to tell Apple how they cracked the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters after the agency spent $1.3 million to have a third party unlock it. What's next in the battle over privacy and encryption? But first, we talk about Donald Trump's speech on foreign policy in Washington, D.C. yesterday. We are joined by Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the speech. What did you make of it? It was a big announcement. Obviously, the media has been glued to Trump's speech. They wanted to find out, was he presidential? What was his real foreign policy? Of course, he's made a lot of off-the-cuff remarks, but this wasn't off-the-cuff. This was an attempt by Trump to outline what his real foreign policy looks like. Can you talk about it?
Sure. I think there's a lot to say, really. I mean, on the surface, the general sweeping view I would have is that it's clear that in Washington, he has aligned himself with foreign policy advisors that are not the usual neocons. So that's good news to a degree. That's why you hear so much gnashing of the teeth in Washington. On the other hand, the people that he does have around him are realists to a degree. But that is not super satisfying to a non-interventionist and to an anti-war person, because realists, as much as tactical allies, I will welcome their friendship. They lack the philosophy that we have of avoiding war and of avoiding entangling alliances. So that's a long way of saying there was a lot that I liked that I heard from his speech, but sadly, I knew that the conclusions, the specific plans that he outlined, A, were not very well hashed out, and B, they don't make a lot of sense. He started out good. After the end of the Cold War, our foreign policy veered badly off course. Absolutely. You know, many of us have been saying that for 20-some years. We failed to develop a new vision for the new time. Absolutely true. However, the new vision for the new time would have been to stop confronting, stop regime changing, stop having the military create an American empire overseas, and he doesn't see that as the problem. So it's a mixed bag, I guess, is a way of saying it.
Daniel McAdams, let me ask you about, go over some of the points in his talk. He said it's an America first foreign policy. He obviously made the trade issue, which of course the trade agreements of the past 20 years have done great damage to the lives and communities that, you know, working people inhabit in the United States and elsewhere. It's, NAFTA wasn't just bad for American workers. It was very bad for the people in Mexico, very good for investors, perhaps very good for corporations, but bad for people. But I want to talk about the other parts of the foreign policy. He talked about Iran. He said Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran nuclear deal, the agreement signed by the P5 plus one, which of course includes the United States and Iran, that it was a terrible deal, that it should be undone, that when he becomes president, he'll make sure that Iran can't get a nuclear weapon. He made a big point about the fact that the Obama administration has created a strain in the relationship, and implied with Israel, implied that it was partly because of the arms deal with Iran. I mean, it sounded, his arguments sounded very bellicose towards Iran. I mean, how do you perceive that for the prospects of peace in the Middle East?
I think that's the one area where he sounds the most neocon-ish. And my guess is that he knows very little about the Iran deal, just like he knows very little about the other specifics whenever he does get specific. I think he's been told a lot of these things. We saw his performance in front of AIPAC a while ago, which was so groveling that it almost became a parody of an AIPAC speech. Maybe that was intent, and I don't know. But, you know, this groveling to Israel, this blind condemnation of the Iran deal, while Iran is not, as far as I know, is not bombing its neighbors like Saudi Arabia, is actually involved in Syria in trying to put down Islamic terrorism, which he claims to be against and wanting to fight. Iran hasn't invaded another country in hundreds of years. So I don't get his beef, and I don't think he gets his beef. It just sounds good and makes him sound tough.
Yeah. On North Korea, he said that he demanded that China take action against the DPRK. There again, very bellicose. I mean, here you have in and offshore the North Korean territory and in its nearby waters, the United States and South Korea carrying out routine, massive military exercises that simulate the destruction of the DPRK, simulate the bombing of the DPRK, a country, of course, that was very seriously bombed between 1950 and 53, when the main complaint of U.S. pilots was that there was nothing left to bomb because there was not one structure taller than one story still standing. And yet the North Koreans are saying to the United States, and have been saying, we'll suspend all nuclear tests if we can talk about a peace treaty to end the Korean War. But Trump, even though he says he's a non-interventionist, his rhetoric was very much in the mold of what Clinton and Obama and before that Bush were doing. What do you think about that one?
Yeah, I mean, this to me is a continuation of the current foreign policy and the predecessor of Obama's foreign policy, which I think has gotten worse under Obama. But you pointed out exactly, Brian. We send naval warships equipped with the latest equipment 50 miles from Russian territory in the Baltic Sea, conducting military exercises. The Russians are annoyed and irritated, and they fly over. And we say, oh, my goodness, how aggressive, how dare you. We send military ships and planes over the South China Sea, which the last time I looked was not close to the U.S. And when the Chinese get annoyed, we say, oh, how dare you, this is terrible. The same thing has happened with North Korea. There's no sense that there is a reaction to our action, that our actions, we're ever responsible for our actions. So in that case, I think it's a huge blind spot. Again, you know, I'm not sure he knows what he's talking about when he does this. But yeah, that is definitely a low point, this bellicose view. We don't have to fall in love with North Korea. We can just simply pull back from the aggression and the tough rhetoric and see what happens.
Let's talk about the Middle East. Trump decried the Iraq war and the Libya war. He stated that both countries were destroyed because of U.S. actions, although he never mentioned George W. Bush's name. He put it pretty much on the plate of Obama and Hillary Clinton. But he said that the United States were trying to impose Western democracies on countries that did not want Western democracies. He said that he would destroy ISIS, and he didn't say exactly how, but he did sort of make the point that the space had been created for the rise of ISIS, which of course is true, by U.S. a destruction of existing sovereign, nationalist, non-religious governments in Iraq, in Libya, and partly in Syria. I think that part of the message will resonate with a big part of the American people who really think the whole policy was catastrophic. What was your take on that?
Well, this is where I think he's either very clever or fairly goofy, because on the one hand, he says something that sounds good to non-interventionists, we're getting out of the nation-building business. Of course, I think Bush promised that too. But on the one hand, he says that. Then on the other hand, he says something like, Obama went in there and just bombed Libya and then walked away. Well, that's the whole point. Not walking away means staying in and doing nation building. So he doesn't understand what caused the problem. He also promises to use military force to contain radical Islam. And he talks about, why are we not bombing Libya right now? And I'm assuming he's thinking of other places. But he admitted earlier on that ISIS was the one who was advantaged by bombs in the first place, the bombing of Libya, the bombing of Iraq, et cetera, created a vacuum, he said, that created ISIS. So how can doing more of what caused the problem solve the problem? It doesn't make any sense.
In fact, this speech is full of contradictions. In the beginning, he starts by saying, we're going to make America great again. Our nuclear weapons are in disarray. They're old. In other words, like the United States is this weakened giant, even though the Obama administration, in violation of the NPT, has actually been modernizing a new generation of more, quote, usable, close quote, nuclear weapons. And then at the end of his speech, he said, the problem is there's too many weapons. We have to have peace. I want to bring peace on Earth. I mean, it just really seemed to be patched together.
Yeah. And I, you know, here's where I think our friends in the military industrial complex who are hovering around Trump now that it looks like he may well win the Republican nomination, and who knows how far he'll go. This whole notion that we must rebuild our military from what? You know, we spend more than most of the world combined. We have an enormous military. We're involved in 120 some countries. What he means by rebuild the military is keep Washington and its environs extraordinarily rich, the richest counties in the country, the McMansions everywhere, to keep Washington and environs extremely rich on the backs of working people in the rest of the country who are seeing their income shrink year after year as the Fed inflates the currency or devalues currency by printing more of it. It's a tax on the poor, and that poor goes to the rich, and the rich are the people who are going to benefit even more by this so-called rebuilding of our military.
Right. I spoke to someone recently about the F-35, for instance, this new generation of stealth fighter bomber, $200 million per plane, probably $400 million per plane, more than $1 trillion. And that's all about making America great again. And when you spend $200 million per plane, obviously those planes aren't going to be used except in war, but they're certainly going to be used in the sense of draining the national treasury, taking money from some place to put it in some other place. I mean, Trump really isn't serious. It doesn't seem to me to be. I mean, he's talking about putting America first, but you really can't put, quote, America first, meaning the lives of working people or the jobs, and allow the military-industrial complex just to run amok.
Well, the F-35 is a great example, Brian, because it's built, I think, in at least 48 states in the U.S. and in 5 foreign countries. So these are jobs for people who are well connected, and it also guarantees that the congressman will not vote against it because there are jobs in their district. But you know, anyone who knows anything about the F-35 knows that it's a piece of junk. You know, I'd rather put wings on a turbine and call that a jet fighter than have the F-35 out there. It's no good. And the military, you know, is not that crazy about it either, but it's a lot of jobs and a lot of money. And it's very unfortunate that these are the kinds of things that will, you know, that will be successful for rebuilding the military.
We're talking to Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. We're talking about Donald Trump's speech yesterday on foreign policy. We have about 3.5 minutes left, Daniel. I want to ask you, because this will undoubtedly make a lot of headlines in Russia, because the tone, the politics in Washington have been so anti-Russia for the past few years, especially, and picked up ever more so after the Ukraine coup d'etat in 2014 and the decision, the referendum in Crimea by the people there to reaffix to Russia proper, Trump said, well, we should not treat Russia as an existential enemy, essentially, that there should be peace and discussions with Russia. That represents something of a different tone from other politicians, even from Hillary Clinton or the existing Obama administration, and certainly the Republican mainstream establishment. What'd you make of that?
Yeah, and I've been critical through most of our conversation, Brian, but I think there were a lot of very high points. If he'd follow through, I think it'd be terrific. Russia is one of those. Here's what he said exactly. We should seek common ground based on shared interests with Russia. He said he'd make a deal that's good for us and good for Russia. That sounds terrific. If he follows through with that, I think we should be very optimistic about it. If I can just add one other thing that annoyed me slightly is this notion that we're going to make our allies pay for NATO. They're going to pay for us to defend them. That essentially turns our military into an army for hire on the one hand. And two, I don't think he understands the reason why we foot most of the bill is because that means we get to call the shots. And if the other countries are paying much more of the share, I think they're going to be more hesitant to embrace Washington's imperial policy throughout the world. So he should probably be careful what he wishes for on that.
Right, because another way of diminishing the cost of NATO would be to abolish NATO. I mean, it's not really clear, and Trump didn't speak to it, why have NATO? I mean, the Soviet Union I had the Warsaw Pact countries as military allies during the Cold War. The United States constructed NATO in 1948. Obviously, the Soviet Union is no more. The NATO mission just grows and grows and grows. Donald Trump didn't talk about the fact that its further expansion east is not only a violation of the post-Cold War agreements with Russia, but it's a vast building of a new military network. And military networks just start to wither unless they become utilized. In other words, it incentivizes war.
Yeah, and I think that's where he also gets it muddled. He wants to have more mission creep. I was excited a few weeks ago when he said NATO is outdated and has reached, you know, past its usefulness. But what he said in the speech yesterday was that he wants to use NATO to confront migration problems and Islamic terrorism. So he's looking, rather than looking to shut it down, he's looking for a new mission for NATO. And I think that's extremely unfortunate. He's missing a great opportunity to really change our foreign policy for the better, which would be to dump NATO for good.
Yeah, and certainly the refugee migrant crisis could be solved if the U.S. would stop continuing, or its allies would stop continuing, the terrible war in Syria that has created such a tremendous crisis for the people there and now for Europe. We've been speaking to Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The newest round of talks on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, is taking place in New York this week. But what exactly is the TTIP, and why are most of the negotiations being carried out in secret between the United States and the European Union? We are joined from London by John Hillary. He is the executive director of War on Want. Welcome, John Hillary.
Thank you very much.
We're hearing a lot about the TTIP in recent days. President Obama pushed the trade deal on his recent trip to the UK and Germany. But what exactly is the TTIP, and why are the negotiations being carried out in such a secretive fashion?
Well, the TTIP, or as we call it, TTIP, is this massive new transatlantic trade deal being negotiated by the European Union and the USA. And it stands for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership because it aims to cover all of the aspects of our commercial relationship, trade, investment, setting up operations in each other's territories. And the reason why they're having to do it behind closed doors in such secrecy is because they realize that if people see exactly what's being traded away here, there's going to be absolute outrage. And already we've seen huge demonstrations across Europe, and I think increasingly anger in the USA as well, about what people are seeing is inside TTIP. And the reason for that is because TTIP is not your traditional trade deal. TTIP is not like all of the trade deals that were negotiated in the 20th century, which was about coal or steel or coffee or beans. TTIP is about deregulation. It's about getting rid of all of the standards, the regulations, and the rules which protect our environment, which protect our health, which protect our jobs. And what they're doing in New York this week is they're trying to trade away on both sides of the Atlantic all of the rules and regulations which we think are so important, but big business wants to get rid of. And that's why there's so much outrage about it.
How do we know what's in TTIP if, in fact, the discussions are secret? In the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that negotiation was also held in secret, but part of the prerequisite for getting any support within Congress for the bill to even be discussed is that at least some sectors of the population would have an opportunity to look at the provisions, and then they were very alarming to people. And right now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership may be on its last legs. We don't know what will take place. But how do you know what's in these negotiations if they are secret?
A similar level of secrecy to the one we saw with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Certain MPs, members of parliament, certain members of the European Parliament have been given very restricted access to the text. But for the rest of us, it comes through leaked documents, which we've been smuggled out from the secrecy bunker. And it also comes from some of the the personal contact we've had with our own representatives who've been able to say, look, these are the things that we're talking about. I mean, right from the beginning, the USA and the EU made explicit that what they were talking about in TTIP was the removal of what they call regulatory barriers to trade. And when we said, well, what are those barriers in your terms? They gave us a big list: environmental standards, labor standards, food safety, public health, all of the things which we value. And that's how we got a sense of what was actually on the table here. Then we were able to force the European Union to expose what it was putting into the TTIP negotiations. So we've seen much more of the European side. But the problem we have is that the devil is in the detail. Until you can actually see what is on the table, what's actually in the text of TTIP, then you can't get a real sense of its impact. And ultimately, that's where people are so concerned, because what we have seen is terrifying. So we think, well, what we haven't seen is probably even more terrifying.
The negotiations were set to be finalized by the end of 2014. Now it looks like they may be finalized in 2019 or 2020. Is it because of grassroots opposition that this has slowed down, or are there other factors here?
It's partly due to the opposition. That's absolutely right. I mean, take one of the most contentious elements of it, which is the setting up of this new system whereby there will be an investment court for corporations to be able to sue the host government if they have their profits harmed in the future. Well, that was so unpopular that they had to suspend negotiations on that for a full year and a half before they could even resume them. So they're way behind on their schedule. But partly also, they've bitten off so much more than they can chew here. The idea that they could race through these negotiations so quickly was always a bit of a dream. But I think what's really important for us is the longer they take, the more people get to hear about what's in TTIP. And I think that's really important, because the more people hear about it, the more they are outraged that our governments could even conceive of doing such a dirty deal. And that's why I think for President Obama, when he was over in Britain and in Germany just this last week, he was desperate to try and push these negotiations forward, because he knows that time is running out, and the longer it goes on, the more chance they have of failing altogether.
I just want you to comment on the motivation there. I mean, President Obama is going to be leaving office in January 2017. In the United States, in this current election cycle, trade and the trade deals like NAFTA or TPP or this trade deal, trade in general, which are really investors' bill of rights in essence, and blocking, breaking down barriers to privatization, allowing corporations to, you know, traverse the globe freely without obstacles or inhibitions or regulations. All of that has become so unpopular that even Hillary Clinton, who in the past supported TPP, and of course her husband signed NAFTA, she too says, no, she's against TPP. Why is President Obama so committed to the TTIP and to these other trade deals? I mean, what's motivating him?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that increasingly we're seeing the candidates who are putting themselves forward for the presidency recognize they cannot be seen to be supporting these deals because they're so toxic. Of course, President Obama has the luxury of not standing for re-election. He's had his two terms. And so in a sense, he doesn't have to play to popular opinion anymore. And it's interesting that he can do that because he doesn't have to be re-elected. That's a direct mirror of the situation in the European Union, because in the European Union, it's the European Commission which is doing the negotiating. And the European Commission is unelected, it's unaccountable, it's untransparent. It's a body that sits in Brussels, which is devoid of any democratic leverage from the rest of the European people. And I met with the Trade Commissioner, Cecilia Malmström, and I asked her in a private meeting, what is it that makes you promote this deal so much when you know that it's so incredibly unpopular with the European people? And her answer to me was, I do not take my mandate from the European people. And I think that says it all. You know, for her, for President Obama, for anybody who doesn't need to be elected, they can promote the deal. But any politician which wants to, you know, show their face in the future has to be really, really careful because everybody else is so dead against TTIP.
Democracy, rule of the people, but the officials shepherding this project don't want to be answerable to the people. They don't think they need to be answerable to the people. So it's not the rule of the people. So it's the rule of what then? What are we looking at?
It's the rule of big business. I mean, it's quite clear that when they were trying to put together the basic mandate for the TTIP negotiations, they didn't come to us, they didn't come to the environmental groups, they didn't go to the trade unions, they didn't go to community groups. They only went to the representatives of big business, the big industrial lobbyists. They were the ones who were asked, what would you like to see in TTIP? And so it's absolutely no coincidence that what we see in TTIP as it's being put together is a wish list drawn up by big corporations. And it is. It's written by big business for big business. So you can forget, you know, the rule by the people for the people. This is a plutocracy where the 1% are going to do very well and the 99% are going to get absolutely nothing.
Talk about the investor courts. Who are the judges? How does that all, what's that legal proceeding like?
Well, this was a really, really contentious element because, of course, this will give U.S. corporations the opportunity to sue European states for any infringement of their right to make profits into the future. And similarly, it will give European big business the right to sue in the U.S. And the key problem for us is the principle of the thing. You know, in the past, when you had trade deals between countries, you had to be a country to be able to sue another country. That's how it works at the World Trade Organization, the WTO. But now we're seeing investors, these private companies, being elevated to the same status as the nation state. And they get the right to be able to sue, not because they've had a contract infringed or anything like that. This is where they can sue just because they feel that they won't be able to make the same profits in the future as a result of a new regulation or a new law which has been brought in. And the concern that people have really had is that these new courts, this new court system which is being proposed, is largely made up of corporate lawyers who are only going to apply trade law when they sit in judgment. So they're not going to do like our normal court system would do, which is to balance the interests of business versus the interests of society. Instead, they're just going to look at the narrow focus of, is this an infringement of free trade? And we've seen where that leads. You know, we know it from the North American context, from NAFTA in the past, that when Canada introduced a law banning a toxic fuel additive, which had already been banned across the rest of the world, they were immediately sued by the U.S. corporation Ethyl. And the Canadian government had to back down, had to issue an apology, and had to withdraw the ban, even though they knew that this was a toxic fuel additive.
Let me just ask you, John Hillary, about this, because I want our audience to kind of wrap their head around it. In the United States, we have the legislative branch of government. That's the House and the Senate. We have the judicial branch, the courts, the top court being the Supreme Court. And, of course, the executive branch, you have the White House. You're talking about some institutions, a court system that's really outside of all of the existing governmental structures, be they in the United States or within European countries or within the EU structure. How does one become a judge and how does the court work?
That's absolutely right. It's a completely new system. And part of it is that we don't know how it's going to work because it's still really just a proposal. In the past, what happened is that the different parties to these disputes, so that the corporation and the country which was defending itself, would each recommend one judge, and then those two judges would recommend a third judge. But what they're now suggesting is that this is going to be a completely new form of the legislative and judicial process. So basically, instead of the equality before the law, which we all have to abide by, this is a completely privileged court system made available only to big corporations themselves. And that's part of the problem. You know, we will never have access to these courts. No domestic company will have access to these courts. No government will have access to it. It's only for these big foreign investors that they get to bring cases and sue for billions and billions of dollars.
It almost sounds like fiction. I mean, you have in secret a new sort of parallel way of living, way of ruling being developed in secret. And all of the countries that profess to be democracies and that have elective representation are excluded except some sectors of the society, that is the elites, the privileged, the attorneys who are representing the privileged or the corporatocracy or the plutocracy. It's just really shocking when you break it down. Let me ask you, how would the TTIP undermine public services? How does it do damage to the environment and food? What about banking regulations? I'm asking you three big questions because I just realized we only have 4 minutes left. But if you could just, to the extent possible, sort of break that down.
Well, let me whistle through those three questions. On public services, we know, for example, that health, education, water, post, rail, all of the key public services are included within TTIP. We've seen the document which says that these are on the table to be traded away. And the idea there is if you have privatized one of your public services, or if you've allowed the private sector to have any access to it, once you put it in a trade deal, then it becomes effectively irreversible. You can't get that type of public service back into public hands. And that's a real fear that we have, that whenever there is a privatization, it's locked in forever and you won't be able to get it back. The second question in terms of food safety and other regulations like that, it's really, really important for us, particularly in Europe, where we have higher food standards than pertain in the United States. So, for example, there's a massive resistance in the European Union to the inclusion of any genetically modified food. And in the States, obviously, it's a much more accepted thing. Now, again, this goes to the heart of our democracy. Why should we be forced to eat genetically modified food just because big business want to sell it to us? Why also should we have to eat pork or beef, which is laced with growth hormones, when they have been found to be carcinogenic? And then this final issue around the whole banking crisis and everything like this. This shows that the sort of thing we're looking at in TTIP is a real danger to democracy and our economic well-being. In the wake of the 2008 crisis, President Obama and the U.S. administration did introduce some more important restrictions on banks so that you've actually tried to prevent a recurrence of the 2008 crash. And what we're seeing now is that the big banks in London, Frankfurt, Paris are saying we want to get rid of all of those rules. Now, the impact on jobs is known to be disastrous. The official statistics, these are not our calculations, the official statistics for TTIP show that at least 1 million jobs will go as a direct result. The calculation is that 680,000 will go in the European Union and 325,000 in the USA. And that's an absolute minimum. And we know from NAFTA that you can expect even more of that once the years and years go by with these agreements in place. So really, the basic news about TTIP is it's great if you're in the 1%. It's great if you're a big business leader or a financier on Wall Street. But if you're anybody else in the 99% ordinary working people in Europe and in the USA, TTIP is a disaster.
We have been talking to John Hillary from London. He's with War on Want. We've been talking about TTIP, the trade deal that John Hillary says and millions of people in Europe and in the United States say will be a disaster for democracy and for people's rights. You have been listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The FBI is unlikely to tell Apple how they cracked the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters after the agency spent $1.3 million to have a third party unlock it. What's next in the battle over encryption and privacy? We are joined by Steve Rambam. He is a private investigator and founder and CEO of Pelorium Incorporated. Welcome back, Steve.
Hi, glad to be back.
Why has the FBI said it will not share the way it unlocked the phone of one of the San Bernardino shooters?
Well, there are a number of reasons, none of them particularly polite or, in my opinion, acceptable. The primary reason is they don't want to reveal how ridiculously easy it was in the end. This was a national hullabaloo. It was going to become, at a certain point, probably a constitutional law issue. And in the end, The FBI spent what for them is pocket change. They got an off-the-shelf solution, what's called a zero-day exploit, an exploit that allows you to break into a system that is not generally known. They cracked the iPhone and they moved on. And the big question, of course, for people who care to ask this question is, why didn't they do this in the first place?
Right, and why didn't they do it in the first place? That was the question.
Well, they didn't do it in the first place for an incredibly obvious reason. The FBI, and more than the FBI, the Department of Justice, their parent body, has for the past year or so been looking for an outrageous case where they could litigate and get authority to get into any digital system. And here you have two of the most repulsive characters on the planet, two jihadis who machine gunned a bunch of innocent people in the United States, an outrageous situation. The FBI is saying we've got to get into these creeps' devices. And more than that, we need to do this because we don't know who they were talking to, who their command and control was. We don't know, and here's where everybody is supposed to gasp, because it's possibly true. We don't know if there's more attacks planned. So we've got to get into this device. If there's any situation where the FBI and the DOJ would be given what they want in this type of scenario, this is it. So they had this situation. I think they, in part, manufactured a crisis, and they ran with it.
When you say they manufactured the crisis, they didn't necessarily manufacture the shooting, but they took advantage of the shooting to have a very emotional issue and sort of make it to the public, say, well, look, Apple doesn't want to help catch terrorists. I mean, that's kind of the message.
Exactly right. This is a potential imminent danger, which I think at that point nobody genuinely believed it was. Let me back up a second. I'm an investigator. I am not anti-law enforcement. I do believe that law enforcement should have the right and the ability to get into certain devices. They should have the key to a criminal's house. What they shouldn't have is the key to everyone's house. And that's what they were trying to get. They were trying to get a master key to every Apple device, essentially. And what they've done is they've shot themselves in the foot. Apple is now manufacturing a new operating system with what's called a secure enclave, where even Apple is not going to be able to get into most of these devices. Now, will hackers eventually find an exploit? Of course they will. And then Apple, in 24 hours, once they know of the exploit, will fix it. And the FBI will be behind the eight ball. And as a result, I think all of us will be behind the eight ball. I think the FBI handled this as badly as they possibly could. And by the way, parenthetically, the crisis existed in the first place because some knucklehead at the FBI reset that phone's iCloud password. And then they couldn't even get the iCloud backups.
Was it a victory for Apple when the FBI dropped the litigation against the company?
No, because Apple has been shot in both feet. If the FBI has been shot in one foot, Apple has been shot in two feet. First of all, you now have a situation where Apple phones, iPhones, are being cracked left and right. Nobody knows how it's being done. Apple doesn't know how it's being done. And by the way, there's a provision, partially formal, partially informal provision at the federal level that says if we find an exploit that allows people to get into a digital system, we, the federal government, will notify the relevant private entity about this. Normally, had Apple and the FBI cooperated, the FBI, if they had cracked the phone themselves, would have told Apple how they did it so Apple could close this gaping hole. But because the FBI can now say with a semi-straight face, gee, we don't know how this was done. Apple forced us to have to go to a third party and pay millions of dollars. We don't have anything to turn over because, golly gee, we don't know how it was done. And I think Director Comey is kind of laughing about that, because the big loser here is Apple. The image of iPhones as invulnerable and impermeable has gone out the window. Now, I can't imagine any intelligent person really believing that you can't get in to any operating system ultimately. But there are people who really were running out and buying iPhones because they thought it would protect their privacy. And, you know, it's a topic for an entire different show, but I can tell you that iPhones are horrendous when it comes to privacy.
I'd like to have a discussion about that on another show, but if you could just spend a minute or two talking about why that's the case, because that really does go against the grain, at least in terms of public perception. The government said that when Apple was standing up to the FBI and refusing to create a backdoor, weaken, sabotage its own product, the iPhone, so that the FBI could break into it, and Apple was making the point, this gives, as you said, a key not just to this phone, but to everyone's phone, a key to everyone's house. The government said, well, Apple is just using this as a marketing ploy to sell Apple phones because it shows how strong and how seriously encrypted they are. But you're saying, in fact, the opposite has happened.
Well, first of all, I have to say that that was the one time that Comey was right. It was a marketing ploy in part. I don't think it was entirely a marketing ploy. I think that there are a number of very principled people at Apple. But look, a huge percentage of all iPhones are backed up to the cloud. Apple has direct access to all of that data. If they can't get it off your phone, it's sitting on their own computer servers. More than 50% of iPhones running all operating systems are backing up to the cloud. And a lot of people, by the way, are doing that without knowing about it. Apple has a large amount of Apple's revenue every year comes from advertising and selling things to people who buy their hardware, who buy their iPhones. And Apple is gathering a lot of that information themselves. What Apple essentially was saying was, we're not going to give it to the feds, but we're grabbing it ourselves and using it ourselves. And I think when you take the next logical step and say, you know, the FBI is trying to fight terrorists and criminals, Apple is trying to sell us soda, you know, which is more important? The truth is both sides are full of crap. I think that Apple is being very disingenuous and very dishonest at times.
When you say that, in addition to the people who select to have their information stored in iCloud, that a lot of people do it without their own knowledge, how does that work?
Well, you have to really lock down your iPhone when you buy it. And this is something very important for your listeners to understand. You have to turn off location services. You have to turn off iCloud backups. You have to essentially put your phone into a little digital bubble. And that's something that you have to manually go in and do and know how to do. Each app is requesting access to your microphone. 45% of all apps on iPhones, that's the latest survey statistic, 45% of all apps on iPhones leak significant private personal data. Everything from your location to accessing your microphone. There's a notorious app called Flashlight. All Flashlight does is it makes your screen glow bright, so you can use your iPhone as a flashlight. It's a ridiculous app. Millions of copies have been installed, and if you look at what Flashlight does, it gets access to your address book, it gets access to your location, it gets access to your microphone. Why? Because it's gathering data. There's a saying in the investigative community and in the IT security community, if you're getting something for free, you are the product being sold. And that's really true. iPhones are a little snitch in your pocket. They report where you are, who you're talking to, what you're doing, what's important in your life. There is so much information on an iPhone that if I've got your phone, I essentially have a window into your soul. I can tell you as an investigator When I'm investigating someone, the first thing I try to hit is telephone data. And by that, I don't mean just telephone calls. I mean everything that you're doing with your, what is essentially a computer in your pocket, your Facebook activity, your Twitter activity, your Flickr, your Instagram, your Snapchat, your location data. And I could go on for a half hour.
So the smartphone technology has helped make your job a bit easier.
It has. And I'll tell you, I'm a little schizophrenic about that. I mean, as an investigator, people putting all that stuff out in cyberspace and in cloud services and revealing everything about themselves as an investigator, you know, my response is thank you. As a member of the community, however, frankly, I'm horrified.
Yeah, I hear you. On a related note, I wanted to ask you, Steve. We're talking to Steve Rombaum. He's a private investigator, the CEO and founder of Pelorium. We're talking about the Apple FBI contest competition, refusal by Apple to open up its iPhone, but now the FBI has cracked the iPhone and obviously can do it over and over and over again. On a related note, Congress is taking up the Email Privacy Act that would require authorities to get a warrant before asking for old emails. Would this be a blow to NSA metadata programs or other mass surveillance programs? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and I'm delighted you brought it up because this is exponentially more significant than the iPhone kerfuffle. Everybody has email. And everything important in your life eventually finds its way to email. I mean, today people get divorced by email. They transmit their most significant business secrets by email. There is currently a reg in the United States that says that if email is over 6 months old, essentially it's in the garbage. Anybody who wants to can look at it. No warrant is needed. Nothing is needed. And there are also provisions, simultaneously also provisions, that allow law enforcement to get into your more current email. It is outrageous. The world has changed since these laws and these regs were enacted. Email is pretty much the most sensitive type of communication out there. It's certainly at least as sensitive as telephone conversations. There has to be a recognition of the new reality. And there has to be laws that say if you want somebody's most sensitive communications, you have to get a warrant to do it. And what's frightening is most people believe you need a warrant. Only the tiniest percentage of the community is aware, as you are and as you just mentioned, that that stuff is out there. Now, as far as metadata goes, metadata, I know, is the buzzword du jour. Can somebody get the headers from your email and use it? Yes, they can. And that's going to be irrespective of a warrant unless some genuinely enlightened person writes a new law. The fact that I'm sending an email to you, you know, to your specific email address at a given date and a given time, that's not going to be locked down. Hopefully, God willing, the content of that email will be locked down, but right now it's not. But the fact that you're communicating with person X, that won't be locked down. And again, I've got to mention this because this is always overlooked. Your email provider has access to all that data, even when the FBI and the CIA and the NSA and the NYPD and what have you don't. You have signed a terms of service that allows Google to look into your Gmail or Yahoo to look into your Yahoo.com email account. People need to be, in my opinion, considerably more concerned with private industry and marketing efforts and the extraordinary privacy invasion of Google and Apple and Yahoo and what have you, which is light years worse than what the FBI and the CIA and the NSA are trying to do.
How is it worse? Because people have a generalized fear of big government. I mean, there's both on the left and the right, there's deep suspicion about U.S. intelligence agencies, law enforcement, the taking advantage, as they did in the case of San Bernardino, of terrible, horrific acts or actions or terrorist actions to, you know, chip away at or just carry out a full-scale assault on essential civil rights, civil liberties, privacy concerns. But how is it, from your point of view, as an investigator, that the danger coming from the corporate world is, in fact, even greater?
Look, I teach a class to law enforcement and to private industry on open source intelligence. And the first thing that I do is I say, if I rubbed a bottle and a genie popped out, and that genie gave me a wish, and I had a choice between all the data that the U.S. government has on everybody, FBI, CIA, NSA, everything, or I had a choice between having access to all the data that Google and Apple and Facebook and private industry has, it wouldn't even take me a second to make that decision. Private industry, hands down. Private industry knows everything about you. And they obtain that data for the most obnoxious of reasons. They're trying to sell you stuff. They want you to buy a T-shirt with a picture of a cat on it. And as opposed to that, as obnoxious as U.S. law enforcement may occasionally be, the FBI and CIA and the NSA genuinely has an important function. They are genuinely trying to keep us safe. Sometimes they do it in a stupid and a ham-handed way, but they have a critical function. What they're doing is legitimate and is important. What Apple and Google are doing is rarely legitimate, and it's never important. They should not have access to that level of data.
Okay, thank you very much. We have been joined by Steve Rambam. He is a private investigator and the founder and CEO of Pelorium Incorporated. That's all the time we have. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and